The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Bugler! Let's personalise this non-episode a little bit. I hope you personally had an absolutely phenomenal Christmas. Far better than all other Buglers, even if you don't really believe in commercial exploitation of religious festivals, and were just going along with it to keep your family happy. I am Andy Zaltzman, and the highlight of my Christmas was when I gave my two little children their first goal. A football goal, that is, not a personal development goal, or a productivity target, a football goal. And it was an absolutely lovely moment, completely priceless, to see the look of excitement, of wonderment and sheer elation on their little faces. Sorry, on my little face. Goal! Zaltzman! Goal! That's what Christmas is all about. Other than that, not much to report, other than A, absolutely nailing a venison steak with red currant and brandy sauce on Christmas Eve. Perfection on a plate, although I must say the antlers were a little bit on the chewy side. And B, actually seeing John Oliver in the flesh for the first time in nearly 2 years. I've heard his f***ing voice often enough, as indeed of you, but it was lovely to see him. Hasn't he grown? He's a big lad now, isn't he? I remember when he was still in diapers, and when he still called them nappies. So, welcome to Bugle 138, Tale Episode B, the first non-Bugle of 2011, the year that will go down in history, as indeed do most, if not all, years. And what finer way to kick off 2011 than by harking back fondly to 2010, with the official Bugle Best of 2010, your indispensable one-stop definitive history of the year that will always be remembered as the year of the largely disappointing World Cup, and Colonel Gaddafi's voluptuous blonde Ukrainian nurse. January. January will, of course, always be remembered as the month that hosted the most historic event of the year, the 100th episode of The Bugle. And who should gatecrash that party with an early and ultimately undefeatable contribution to the of the year contest but Pat Robertson, the American TV evangelist, and it's okay. He uses that term on his website. He is perfectly upfront about it.
Heartbreaking disaster news now, and obviously the earthquake in Haiti is a humanitarian crisis, the likes of which it can be hard for the Western world to comprehend, especially when it isn't trying particularly hard. But the most reprehensible response so far came from Pat Robertson, the famous American televangelist, who said he believed that Haiti had been cursed due to their entering into a pact with the devil. I'm just going to pause for a moment to allow those words to sink in, and I'm now going to pause for another moment to allow you to slam your head into a table, throw a cup across a wall, or put a saucepan on your head and scream, "What the f*** at the top of your voice."
What the f***?
Okay, with that out of the way, let's try to continue. Robertson went on to say, Haitians need to have a great turning to God, and out of this tragedy, I'm optimistic that something good may come. Oh, that's good. So this is actually a good thing, this earthquake. I've been watching the news in horror when I should have been jealous of the Haitians at the good fortune that Pat Robertson guarantees is on its way to them. If that is, they find Christ. F*** you, Robertson, you unbelievable.
Now, John, I don't like plate tectonics. I think they're total dicks. But I like Pat Robertson even less. As you said, he said some incredible things. He said something happened a long time ago in Haiti. People might not want to talk about it. Sadly, Pat Robertson wasn't one of those people not wanting to talk about it.
Yes.
He said they were under the heel of the French. You know, Napoleon III or whatever. Now, Haitian independence was, I believe, in 1804. Napoleon III of France at that point would have been aged, can you guess anyone? Can you guess Pat Robertson? He'd have been -4, because he was born in 1808 and only came to power in 1852. So, if you're going to spew this prejudice, at least let it be well-informed. He said, they got together and swore a pact to the devil, you say. They said, we will serve you if you get us free from the French. True story, says Robertson. And he said it on a Christian TV station. Christianity, the religion of truth. So it must be true. And then, he said, so the devil said, OK, it's a deal. Now, were those the devil's exact words? Because that would be unusually colloquial for early 19th century dialect.
This theory that Haiti is a nation built on the back of a pact with the devil is based on what I believe the technical term is, a steaming mound of bullshit. Namely, that some Haitian voodoo priests sacrificed a pig and drank its blood in 1791 in order to secure Satan's aid in expelling the French occupation. In return, the priests are said to have promised Haiti to Satan for the next 200 years. The French were soon beaten back, and in 1804, as you said, Haiti became an independent nation. But even if this story is true, which it absolutely isn't, Satan's contract on Haiti would have expired in 1991. So even if you do believe that story, which you shouldn't, Satan at the very least is in violation of the lease he signed.
But this is a fascinating thing. So they got together and swore a pact to the devil. Now, I think another interpretation of this is that they got together and they happened to live on a tectonic fault. Now, this is a fine line, John, and it's amazing how God and the devil seem to predict where evil people would live all those thousands and or millions of years ago when they sliced up the Earth's crust with a jigsaw. And they clearly thought Britain was a safe bet for everyone being good. There's not a fault line in sight here, John. As we know, a bit of snow is as bad as it gets. So we've pretty much got carte blanche to do whatever the we want as a nation, because God is going to struggle to whack back at us. And we've accepted this blessing with humility and dignity and only ever done good for the world. But what about another country without major fault lines? Germany. How many volcanoes and tornadoes and other natural catastrophes do you see there? Boy, did the big man call that one wrong. As this transcript from 1943 proves, God, I really think we should call it an earthquake on Germany. Germany? Just remind me, used to be Prussia? Yep, got it. Pointy hats, big sausages and harpsichords. Near enough, boss. So what have they been up to? Well, what haven't they been up to, boss? I mean, it's really bad. Really, really bad. So if you could sign off on at least a 7 rating EQ, that would be grand. No can do, Gabriel, me old mucker. I didn't legislate for this one, I'm afraid. I thought the sausages would keep them in line, so I didn't think of chucking much in the way of tectonics in too. Silly me. All right. Any chance of a tidal wave? Not really. I haven't really got the geography for it. Hurricane? Fresh out, I'm afraid. Ah, shucks. Oh, well, I could just stick another one to the Bangladeshis or something, shall I? If you must. Yay!
February. And in February, the Bugle joined in the worldwide celebrations of the 20th anniversary of the release of the South African Morgan Freeman himself, Nelson Mandela. Well, almost worldwide celebrations. There were no doubt small pockets of harumphing in parts of South Africa, where some people were probably still muttering, I tell you, no good can come of this.
It was great news for South Africa 20 years ago. Even better news for all of humanity. Slightly less good news, I would argue, for cricket, Andy. The best news of all being for Big Nell himself, who managed to deliver a speech of superhuman restraint after being released after 27 years, in that it somehow, incredibly, didn't start with the words, what the f***? What was that about? Seriously, what the f*** was the last 27 years about? I'm going to need some answers, because I'm pissed off now. Pissed off. Holy shit, that was a long time. I mean, that was a really long time. As part of the celebrations this week, they reenacted in South Africa Mandela's Walk to Freedom. And when I first read that headline, Andy, I had a horrible split-second thought that they might have jailed him again just so they could re-release him. Because that would have been a very nervy moment for Nelson. Yeah, sure, I'm going to get in the cell, but let's just be clear, this is a reenaction, right? It's definitely a reenaction. It's just, the last time you got me in here, you left me here for nearly 3 decades. Well, I don't think I am thumping on about it. I don't think I'm actually doing that. Mandela, who's now 91 or 64, if you don't count the years that were stolen from him, attended a special session of Parliament where he heard President Zuma deliver a tribute. And President Zuma said, in the 2 decades since the release of Madiba, which is Mandela's clan name, our country has changed fundamentally. President Mandela united this country behind the goal of a non-sexist, non-racial, democratic and prosperous South Africa. And those are very noble thoughts, Andy, beautifully expressed, but they do ring a little hollow coming from a man who's been charged with rape, racketeering and corruption, who's been married 5 times and who's just had his 20th child. 20 children, Andy. He's also said that gay marriage was a disgrace to God and that when growing up, a homosexual would not have stood in front of me, I'd have knocked him out. What I'm saying is, President Zuma actually achieves the impossible. He manages to make you appreciate Nelson Mandela even more.
Well, to be fair, he did do the whole speech without marrying or impregnating anyone. So I mean,
that's true.
You know, he's learning, clearly. It does prove what an incredible man Mandela is, the dignity and grace he's shown as a symbol of hope for our stroppy species. And I think looking back, we can now all agree that apartheid was definitely a bad thing.
Yeah, I think, I think we're at that point.
Rude. Very, very rude.
It was impolite.
It was a time of amazing change for the world 20 years ago. In the space of a year, we had the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, Nelson Mandela freed, and Canada rediscovered after lying dormant and undetected for 35 years. It was all happening.
March. Sod March. Never liked it as a month. Neither one thing nor the other. Prick. April, and Britain was gripped by election fever, albeit a strain of election fever whose symptoms involved sitting on the floor saying, And all of a sudden, Britain's historic two-and-a-bit party system exploded like a randy butterfly out of a particularly curvaceous cocoon and became a two-and-a-half party system for a little while.
Bugle feature section now, election mayhem, the revenge of democracy. And I think that's what it's now being called over here. They've just decided to rebrand.
That's a good idea.
Revolution is in the air, buglers. Britain is aflame with the kerosene of upheaval. Everything we thought we knew is false, and a new dawn is dawning. And nothing will ever be the same again, John. All right. This from just a few opinion polls. That's how alive our democracy is. After last week's first prime ministerial TV debate, which was reported exclusively on the Bugle. No other media organ ran with it.
That's almost true.
we told you last week that Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, Britain's third biggest political party, traditionally had done well. Well, in fact, after that, he rocketed up like a 1950s Russian dog in the opinion polls, right to the top, overtaking the massively unpopular government and the quite unpopular opposition. But will Clegg, like that cosmopooch, drift off aimlessly before disintegrating on re-entry to the real world? Well, time will tell. But in the second debate last night, John, it was a little bit of a squabble, but Clegg pretty much held his own. So we have to ask the question, could the Liberal Democrats, the third party traditionally, suddenly roar to victory in the election on a surge of public approval? And the answer is no. Though no, they could not, John, because of our first-past-the-post system, in which each MP is elected directly by his local constituents. It is impossible. I think the Liberal Democrats could get every single vote cast in the country and still only get about 25% of the seats. And in fact, I put this into an online seat predictor, and who am I to argue with the internet, John? Mm-hmm. And I put all three main parties in at 33.3% of the vote.
Right.
And the predictor predicted that Labour would win 320 seats, the Conservatives 210, and the Liberal Democrats 100. So basically what that is saying is, up yours, democracy. We are Britain. We'll do it our British way. Our God-given British way. And if that means some people's votes are worth a fraction of the others, then up yours, voters. We won the war. We'll decide how our democracy work, not you Nazis and or communists.
The Guardian England ran with an article this week describing Nick Clegg as Britain's Obama. And you know, it's unclear as to, you know, whether that's as close to a black person as Britain is willing to elect as a leader, a young white man. But also, it kind of underestimates just exactly what Nick Clegg is up against under the British electoral system. It's even more than Obama was up against with endemic American racism.
There were some amazing attacks on Clegg this week, including this one from the Mail on Sunday, which is traditionally not entirely a vestige of truth. Mm-hmm. And they wrote, his wife is Spanish, his mother Dutch, his father half Russian, and his spin doctor is German. Ooh. Is there anything British about Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg? What a question! And the answer
is,
how much more British could he get? A genetic hotspot willing to scour the world for people to employ. A Spanish wife, links to Holland, Russia and Germany. The guy's basically a member of the royal family. We have the prospect of the first hung parliament since 1974, incidentally, when I was lucky enough to be in the womb, cranking out some top-quality gags about indecisive government and the impossibility of compromise in a traditionally confrontational system, and how stupid umbilical cords look. Yeah. Hey, what's up with them? And who in here is getting sick of the amniotic fluid? What's with that stuff? So, you know how it is when you're waggling your legs about and your foot kicks the wall of the womb? Wow, gross out, man. Anyway, but that is when there was the last hung parliament, when I was safely ensconced in the womb. And as the race has tightened this time round, there's been a slightly bizarre twist in which the fear of a hung parliament has basically become the central plank in the increasingly mouldy hull of the leaky wooden dinghy that is the Conservative campaign. They've really played the don't let there be a hung parliament, we'll probably all die card with a gusto of people who almost revel in their own failure to garner public approval. Oh, forget everything else they've implored voters. We know you don't like us and haven't responded to what we've said we'll do, but surely it's better to have a government that does what you don't want it to do than to have no government not doing anything at all. Vote Conservative! What an inspiring call to arms, John.
May and Britain settle down to a gloriously harmonious new coalition-fueled future and war with America, all because poor little BP had accidentally let an oil rig explode. And did America blame physics for this? Did it f***?
Well, Andy, when we left the Bugle 2 weeks ago, oil was pumping into the ocean off the Louisiana coast and everyone was talking about it. Well, 14 days later, nothing has really changed other than the human response going from shock to depressed resignation. The leak is still pumping out oil like John Grisham pumps out novels, indiscriminately and on an almost incomprehensible scale. There's a time and a place for oil, Andy. Most of the time, that place is under the ground. It is not, I repeat, not all over a dead fish. Unless the dead fish in question is a seared tuna and the oil in question was squeezed out of an Italian olive. Little joke to remind you of last week there, Andy.
Nice, yeah. I say they don't eat a lot of seared tuna fish down there, John.
Really?
Not a great deal, no.
Oh, what?
Might get a little bit of sea bass.
Oh, yeah?
But not a lot of tuna going on.
Well,
there.
Next time I do that joke, Andy, I'll substitute the tuna for the bass.
Do that.
The Obama administration has responded this week to public concerns that they are not doing enough, making it clear that they're trying everything, from drilling relief wells to firing in mud, golf balls and human hair to clog the pipe up, that's true, to sending down a fat scuba diver to sit on top of the leaking well under the strict instruction not to swim away until they've sorted it all out. And as for the scale of this disaster, it is truly appalling. One media report here said the leak has grown to nearly 19 million gallons over the past 5 weeks. If the oil-filled gallon milk jugs lined up side by side, there would be enough to reach from New York to Chicago and back. You know what? You had my attention there at 19 million gallons. I really don't think a figure like that needs to be put into any further arbitrary perspective. I think basically everyone understands that 19 million gallons of anything is a f*** of a lot of gallons. You're not going to find yourself confused when someone phones you up and says, congratulations, I'm happy to tell you that you just won 19 million gallons of grapefruit juice. The only confusion there is going to be, hold on, what competition did I enter that had that as a prize? Immediately followed by thinking, oh shit, what am I going to do with my brand new massive amount of grapefruit juice? You are not going to find yourself saying, excuse me, but can you give me that information again, but this time in milk jug form? Because I have absolutely no idea whether what you just said is a lot or not. In fact, can you please tell me how far my milk jugs of grapefruit juice would go if lined up side by side? And please express it to me in terms of a round trip, otherwise I'll just get confused again.
June. World Cup! World Cup! World Cup! World Cup! 4-1! World Cup! World Cup. July. World Cup. World Cup. Oh, World Cup. Thank you, Spain, for saving football. August. August was, of course, predominantly noteworthy for my record-breaking Edinburgh Fringe show. Tickets still available, but do hurry, they are going fast. And also for Brazil, jumping on the election bandwagon, and having jumped on it, deciding to ban all satire. And who was bold enough to defy the Brazilian government to stand up to the machinery of the state? The Bugle, at a range of 6,000 miles, and not covered by the ban anyway. Heroes!
We are the Bugle. We do take our responsibilities very seriously, John, and this world isn't going to satirise itself, is it? So, yes, as John said, we will be lampooning the Brazilian election.
Now, one of the reasons why this is going to be so painful for Brazil is that the candidates sound incredibly boring. The front-runner, Dilma Rousseff, has apparently a lumbering speaking manner, and her main opponent, Jose Serra, is widely considered to be lacking charisma. Now, have they found the only two introverted Brazilians in the whole of that bethonged nation, Andy? Is that what happens in Brazil? If you're boring, everyone else makes you run the country while they're outside building 35-foot floats out of marshmallows.
Have you ever been to Brazil, John?
No. Well, I'd love to. The marshmallow floats sound amazing.
Yeah, you just don't eat one in a whole, you know, whole one in a single sitting. That's the key.
So, here we go, Chris. I hope you've unpacked your drum kit and hi-hat, because this shit is about to get zingy. First, let's deal with frontrunner Dilma Rousseff. Here goes. For a start, what kind of name is Dilma? Sounds like Fred Flintstone calling his wife while suffering from a cold. Boom! Boom!
Chief of staff? Chief of staff, more like? Boom! Have you heard her talk? She sounds like an articulated lorry slowly reversing onto a rhinoceros.
Here's another. Hey, Dilma, you're a career civil servant never elected to office. Plus, you are and will continue to be in the pocket of President Lula da Silva. I'm not saying you're a puppet. I'm just saying I bet you can't speak while President Lula is drinking a glass of water. Boom!
I know why she's called the Iron Lady, because she makes everyone she talks to feel flat. like they've been ironed. Iron. You can't handle the truth!
By the way, Dilma, Angela Lansbury called. She wants her entire wardrobe back. I mean, every item of clothing she's ever worn.
Former Secretary of State for Energy. Well, she should be fired. Fired. Is this on? I'm Dynamite.
Hey, Dilma, apparently you joined the underground resistance movement during a military dictatorship and were jailed and tortured between 1970 and 1972. That's an admirable commitment to your beliefs and cause. Hey, they can't all be winners.
What do you get if you cross four decades of political activism with a president who's coming to the end of his second term of office?
What?
Dilma Rousseff running for president. Okay, that needs a bit of work as well, John. That needs a bit of work.
Okay, well, let's move on to Jose Serra, Andy. Apparently, Jose Serra, Andy, was an engineering student. It's a shame he didn't engineer himself a personality. You're welcome, Brazil. De nada.
Jose Serra? Who's he, Serra, more like? Who's he? Former health minister, is he? Well, he didn't make me feel any better this morning. I tell you, Brazil would be nuts if they elect this guy.
Hey, Jose Serra, your wife, Monica Allende, was a top ballerina with the National Ballet of Chile. Well, you can both go spin on this. Jose Serra's campaign slogan is Brazil can do better. You're right, Jose, and Brazil can do a f*** of a lot better than you. That is a burn. That is a third-degree burn all over his personality.
That man has the charisma of a long-forgotten apple core slowly rotting in a disused air race shelter.
Finally, let's deal with the outsider, Andy, former Environment Minister Marina Silva. Marina switched from the Workers' Party to the Green Party a year ago. I haven't seen such a huge party hopper since Paris Hilton was welded onto a pogo stick. Brazil, you've been great. I'm here all week. Try the polenta.
Isn't that more of an Italian thing?
Apparently, it's also in Brazil.
September. Can you guess who was in Britain in September 2010? I was, but who else? My family. And who else? One more guess. The Pope. Correct. The real Pope as well. Not a pretend Pope. The actual Pope. The Pope came to this now predominantly godless land and tried to turn us all into frogs, or whatever it is these guys in fancy dresses do these days.
Any visit like this requires a very deft, diplomatic touch with the inherent tensions available. Sadly, the visit got off to a bad start before it had even begun, when a senior papal advisor said that arriving at Heathrow Airport is like entering a third world country. Presumably, that is not a compliment, Andy. He didn't mean one of those state-of-the-art third-world airports with giant plasma screen departure boards, elegant water features, indoor monorails and three-storey Cinnabons.
Cinnabons?
Cinnabons, Andy.
What are they?
They're a fixture of American airports.
Cinnabons?
You can get a cinnamon roll, cinnamon bun.
Oh, right, I see. I thought it was like some Jewish thing.
No,
trust between a synagogue and a... I don't know, a James Bond theme park.
Well, I would patent that very quickly, Andy.
Well, I thought when he said that, he was actually...
Not open Saturdays.
I thought he was being pretty complimentary. Because, you know, I haven't travelled at Heathrow for a few years now, but when I last travelled there, it wasn't like the third world, John. It was like the seventh circle of hell. So I think describing it as a third world suggests they've made some major improvements.
The cardinal who made these comments was apparently unable to make the trip
to the UK after he was suddenly taken ill. And I'm guessing that the Vatican doctor was instructed to make that diagnosis to him. Cardinal, how do you feel? I'm actually feeling fine. No, you're not. You're feeling like you don't want to get on a plane. No, I'm very much looking forward to the trip. No, you're not. You're coming down with a nasty case of shut your f***ing mouth. The best thing you can do is drink lots of fluids, stay exactly where you are for the next 4 days, and shut your f***ing mouth. But instead of doing that, the Cardinal doubled down on his comment, claiming that he was actually referring to Britain's immigrants. Oh, that's much better. Everybody calm down. This is a huge misunderstanding. I was just being racist. Are we good now?
Well, despite this, 70,000 people apparently turned up to the Mass in Glasgow yesterday, John. That's the biggest live audience any touring character act has drawn in Britain for years. But still well down on the 1982 Pope, who was much, much better Pope. Much for my money, you know. Just, he had that, he had it. He had that X factor.
Yeah.
No, he was like the Jimi Hendrix of Catholicism.
By X factor, do you mean cross?
Oh, yeah, that's what they call it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But his audience has gone down since 1982, clearly, and it shows if you don't keep up your touring momentum, you keep got to keep coming back and
building up
the crowd.
You're right.
Doesn't that when he basically did exactly the same material as John Paul II did in 82? But I know the crowd at big outdoor gigs do want to hear the old favourites, as you say, but he's got to freshen it up. You have to freshen it up.
It's hard to know what was really going on with these Cardinals' comments, Andy. Is the Vatican really that stupid? Well, that is entirely possible. In fact, it's borderline probable. Or are they, in fact, diabolical geniuses? Is this just a clever cup-and-ball distraction trick to try and make people in Britain forget that they're actually supposed to be angry about child abuse scandals?
You shouldn't use cupping balls as
that's true.
In a sentence like that, John.
That's, yeah, I'll take that back. There was no way, though, that the Queen, the big Q, Andy, Q unit... There was no way she was going to let that kind of comment go unchallenged. So she broke out some of the Windsor family's trademark passive aggression, apparently remarking to the Pope when he arrived that he'd arrived in a rather small car. Oh, shit! Have a taste, Benny. You just got queen slapped. She did not just talk shit about your Pope-mobile. That did not just happen. You just got royally served. You got put in your gold-plated place.
October. Usually when someone says the words good news story to me, I instantly assume it involves Silvio Berlusconi and something smashing him in the face, whether that be a replica of a large building, a court case, or his own specially commissioned marble penis. But in October, there was a real good news story. The Chilean miners, not that lot of Chilean miners, not the ones that carried on working as normal in their mines without major alarms throughout the year, the other lots, yeah, those are the ones who got stuck for, how long was it again? Absolutely ages, that's it. They were pinged back to the surface in a special pod, and the world rejoiced.
A great story for the nation of Chile. Previously, of course, best known for that goal Marcelo Salas scored at Wembley in 1998.
Cracking goal.
What a goal. What a goal that was. And also is the country most likely to snap in half if you baked a biscuit in the shape of it. But it's now renowned the world over for its capacity to rescue miners from 2,000 feet underground and provide the world with a gripping and inspiring human interest story that has given us full licence to put absolutely everything else on the back burner for a bit.
Also, let's not look at this, Andy, merely as a moment that demonstrates the human will to survive against all the odds. No, let's also see this as a huge commercial opportunity. Now, you probably noticed that each of the rescued miners came up wearing sunglasses to...
Yep.
Shield their eyes from UV rays after living in complete darkness for so long. It turns out these were actually designer Oakley sunglasses at $450 a pair that were donated by Oakley, who in return received an estimated equivalent of $41 million worth of advertising time. Now, the problem is that a profit margin like that starts to create a potentially dangerous precedent. Don't be surprised if major clothing brands are caught in the future trying to create potential disasters to showcase their goods. All I'm saying is that if a school roof caves in, trapping 500 kids, and Reebok turn up with a truckload of shoes suspiciously quickly, you will know where to point the finger.
Well, I mean, this isn't a new thing, John. I mean, think back to the end of the Second World War, you know, Hiroshima.
Yep.
Big advertising for Hoggins mushrooms. No, it's subliminal, but a lot of people just start feeling a little bit peckish.
It also makes you think that the Gulf oil spill was a huge missed marketing opportunity. Yep. Those oil-covered fish, oysters and crabs should all have been wearing tiny little Kangol hats. That ecological disaster tunity was a licence to print money. Also...
Well, it was clearly rigged. The thing is, John, the rescue was rushed because there were 700 metres, roughly, of that 18-inch wide borehole that the lift had to come through with that little camera on top.
Yeah.
And by my reckoning, that could have provided space for at least 6,300 advertising logos. If they'd only taken the time, it probably would have taken another month or so, but we waited long enough as it was to stick them all to the side of the shaft. And that is a real marketing opportunity missed. And I mean, I think in this day and age, that is probably the greatest tragedy of all.
Well, furthermore, Andy, don't be surprised if Oakley sunglasses commercials have a more ominous tone in the future. Rather than a shirtless man wearing them as a woman in a bikini looks on longingly, it'll just be a single photo of a pair of Oakley sunglasses over the text, "Can you be 100% sure that you won't be trapped 2,000 feet underground in the near future? Didn't think so. That'll be $450, please."
Well, it was an opportunity missed, John. I mean, not only from an advertising point of view, but from a prank point of view. You know, if that first miner out had come out dressed as an alien or as Elvis, and his first words had been, "What year is it?" All I can remember is having that sandwich and falling down the loo.
You're right.
He's never going to have that chance again, John. Yep. He's blown it.
It's never coming back. As each miner surfaced, each had their own response to freedom. The media's instant favourite was Mario Sepulveda, who was instantly christened Super Mario after he led the crowd in euphoric chants and going on to say, "I'm very emotional. I'm going to have a drink. I'm going to drink a lot with my son, Francisco," which sounds great until you hear that his son Francisco is actually only 6 years old. But don't worry. As it turns out, Francisco can really handle his liquor. There's nothing to be worried about.
Well, you've got it in the Atacama Desert, haven't you? You've got to take a pint.
That was from Buell issue 131, when the team was rejoined by ex-producer and Northern Hemisphere reject Tom, who finally came face-to-face with his successor and nemesis, Chris, who was like Khrushchev meeting Kennedy, but more so, and with me in the background having had a couple of glasses of sherry.
And a very special soundproof safe guest, the ex-Bugle producer and former Scotsman, Tom Wright.
Hello, Buglers.
He's escaped!
What?
Shit! From the south.
Shit!
Who the put the lock on the safe?
Get the lid back down before Petula gets
the
out.
First ever man to escape from the soundproof safe. Is everyone else okay in there, Tom?
They are. They are enjoying a very easy time.
Enough nibbles.
It's nice how you treat your former employees, though, I have to say. Yeah.
Just be careful. Don't let sporty pussycat doll get out.
Welcome back, Tom.
Yes,
back
welcome,
one week
Tom.
Only.
Hello, Buglers. Hello.
Back in the Northern Hemisphere. Back the right way up.
It's so weird.
Have you got a message for Chris?
Well, I was going to say hello, John.
This
how
awkward.
Are you?
I want a message for Chris
Paul.
First.
Hello, Andy.
No, tell
you, Chris.
Got him!
No.
Well, Chris... you.
Double f***ing. It's producer tennis. It's like the Cold War all over again. Swearier.
This is healthy. This is healthy. Let's
I've
get
lost
it out.
Count of how many f**ks I'm supposed to write down.
I'm in America now, so this just seems like good therapy. This is just primal scream. Let's talk it out.
But Buglers, hello. I do return from Australia, and I do need to formally endorse Chris as the proper producer of the Bugle.
Oh, there you go. We should have done this at the start. Proper succession.
And it has been done properly. Chris does have a little blooded Bugle ensign on his forehead.
Yes.
He does now. And I am formally drawing a halt to the FU, Chris. Chris, formally.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Buglers, leave him alone.
It's not going to run deeper than that.
Bugle You're, runs deeper than
you,
hatred.
You think you control this, Tom? You've unleashed a vitriolic army that you are no longer in charge of.
That's right.
I have to say, I wasn't the person who started the campaign to bring me back.
Really?
No, because that would just be silly. Yeah.
Before we started recording here, I met Chris and Tom for a couple of glasses of sherry in Gordon's
I think
wine.
That's obvious, Andy. I think and that's obvious.
It's been a few words. I haven't made that full journey from throats to
this
microphone.
Is the first time you should be breathalyzed back there. You're sozzled, Andy. You can't speak.
He had half a glass of Madeira before he poured it on me.
That's right. That is true.
I've never really seen anyone look after such a small amount of alcohol get so aggro?
It's a Jewish thing. Dates back to that, the Egypt days. Oh, I should point out, for the third Bugle birthday, Chris brought in a lovely little cake with the words "F you Buglers" written on it. So I don't know if you want to factor that into your, the way you address it in future emails.
The peace talks were just underway, Andy. That does not help.
F*** you, Buglers, written on it. And in 2007, also, then, you know, when we started, the people of Eastern Europe still lived under the oppressive yoke of the Soviet Empire. Or was it Byzantine Empire? I can't remember. It doesn't matter, they're basically the same. But now, thanks to the Bugle, those people have been freed.
Yep. You're welcome.
Yep. But it's not just that numerical coincidence, John. 131... is also the medical emergency phone number in Chile.
Oh.
In this week of all weeks. So one of those miners probably tried to phone it and then said, oh, balls, no bloody single. Single?
Single. Andy, stop drinking. Stop drinking, Andy.
Dear, this is bad, isn't it?
It's not exactly performance enhancing, I'll give you that.
Yeah. It's like the last days of Alex Higgins in that documentary, you know what he was...
Right. I need to see
that
a lawyer.
That is exactly
if that's
what it is.
Well, I'm going for a frame of snooker afterwards. Alex Higgins, days from death, are still got to be stronger than me at snooker.
Andy, you are the comedic Alex Higgins.
That's going on my poster.
Yeah.
November. In November 2010 came the events that will forever overshadow all events in the history of the planet Earth. The engagement of Prince William, the future King of England, revolutions permitting, and Kate Middleton, the everyday lass who, in a different life, could easily have had to make a living spitting tadpoles into yoghurt pots for the entertainment of drunken businessmen. But luckily, she isn't doing that. She's going to rule us all like a modern-day Joanna the Mad, but better dressed and primped. Very well primped.
Now, it might not look like a big deal when you look at the actual size of the deal that it is, but it feels like a big one. And that is key. Look at it this way, Andy. Kate Middleton could well be our queen one day. And you know what that means? It means we'll be making disrespectful and childish remarks at her expense in the future.
Yep.
I mean,
prepared
that's
to start
something.
Warming up for that day as soon as possible.
I think we're already halfway into it. Details are gradually emerging of the engagement itself. Apparently, Prince William popped the question at a secluded game reserve in the foothills of Mount Kenya. Beautiful location, Andy. He then celebrated by shooting a lion in the face and smearing his bride with the blood. I think they call it a traditional 19th century proposal.
But certainly he'd chosen Kate Middleton ahead of other potential candidates, including Scarlett Johansson, one or both of George W. Bush's daughters, and pop star Lady Gaga, who had the advantage, of course, of being titled aristocracy. And also he turned down any of the world's genuine current standing princesses.
Yep.
And personally, I think this is a mistake. I care much more about the problems, the current interpretations of the Ruck Law in rugby than the royal wedding, to be honest. And as far as I'm concerned, the one remaining function of the royal family is to stop pricks like Peter Maddleton trying to become king. But still, good luck to them. They both seem very nice. And I'm already spoken for, so it's not like he's taking a potential Mrs. Zaltzman off the market. But, and it is a big but, from a patriotic point of view, it is a shame, no, a disaster, that Prince William is marrying for love. Now, I might be a bit old-fashioned about this, but what is the f***ing point of having a prince, John, if you can't marry him off to a princess from another country to form a strategic political partnership?
Yes.
If William had a shred of patriotism, he'd be marrying either Angela Merkel or Chinese President Hu Jintao's daughter, Hai King.
That's who you should be marrying. What's happened to tradition, Andy? What's happened to this country and its values?
Yeah. No, I mean, neither of those is technically a princess, but they are basically de facto princesses.
Yes.
So, as you said, the announcement was instantly met with a predictable reaction of wild media hysteria and whinging, more importantly. And as you said, with the media, the whole of the world's media jumped on board. And when the media goes apeshit, then what happens is that they, even though the public, I'm not sure the public had particularly gone apeshit, but the media then saw the public reading or watching or listening to them going apeshit, and they reported that the public was going apeshit as well. And then they went even more apeshit, and it's a cycle of apeshittery that has no foreseeable end. But the whinging was extraordinary, John. Within literally seconds of the announcement, people across Britain were grumbling about the potential cost to them, the taxpayer. To which there are two very obvious responses. One, lighten the f*** up, big horse. And two, it won't be very much. No, comes the hit back. That wedding is going to cost us more than £20 billion over 9 years. No, you can respond. You're mixing it up with the combined cost to the country of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they reply, yeah, oh, they're all basically part of the same thing. It's all about the oil. That Kate Middleton, they want to run a pipeline through her. And how come she's already agreed that Halliburton can make a wedding dress? Death to the East! I'm confused.
December. If you can't remember what happened in December 2010, you have problems that even we at the Bugle cannot and will not address. So there it is. 2010 in a nutshell. A nutshell shaped like a rapidly hacked together podcast. John and I will be back next week with the first full Bugle of 2011. In the meantime, do send your emails in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And don't forget to book your tickets for my Soho Theatre run, 13th to the 15th of January, on London's glamorous Dean Street. The perfect way to start your year. And the only way to guarantee that, when I say Happy New Year to you at the end of this show, I actually mean it. Until next week, Buglers, bye-bye, keep safe, and stay in school. Unless you're not supposed to be in school, in which case, quietly leave without drawing attention to yourself. And Happy New Year. Bye.